All right, let's continue with our study of Christian virtues. So far, we've learned how to adorn ourselves with a gentle and quiet spirit. I'm hoping that if I were to walk up to you randomly and point at you or you and ask you to describe to me what is the virtue of gentleness, that you know it. You can't put on this virtue if you don't even know what it is. Right? If you hunger and thirst after these qualities, these characteristics, you really have to first understand it, and you have to treasure it in your hearts, or it ain't happening. So the gentleness of spirit is responding, right? It's that habitual responding to provocation with gentleness rather than aggressiveness. That's what it is. What's quietness? That's that calmness. That is the calming of yourself when things are in turmoil around you. That is, again, that firm, habitual disposition or attitude of your heart that when things are chaotic around you, you respond with a quiet spirit. And as I keep emphasizing, when you do that, you're able to begin to think and to reason, and your conscience is able to get to you, right? And the words of God begin to rise up in you because you've been treasuring them in your hearts. And suddenly, it's just amazing, the insights and the wisdom you have while everybody else is going crazy around you. What was the other characteristics? What are the other virtues? I think the third one was compassion, right? What was the bowels of mercy? What is compassion? It's, again, that ability to enter into another person's suffering. That's what it is, to sympathize, to identify. I know what that feels like. And then responding accordingly. And when you have that kind of compassion, it produces in you patience and long-suffering and gentleness, right? When you have that. When you have no ability to sympathize with other people, then you have no thought about being patient with them. You have no thought about being forbearing with them because you don't sympathize with them. Christian compassion, bowels of mercy. And let me tell you, it is a wonderful thing that our God has a lot of this quality. A lot of compassion for us. It would be a terrifying thing if he didn't, even as Christian. The other one, the next one was humbleness of mind, right? Humble-mindedness or humbleness of mind. So again, what is it? The definition of a humble mind is you don't think too highly of yourself and you don't think too lowly of others. A proud person, a high-minded person, always thinks higher of themselves and too low of other people. A low-minded person flips that around and begins to bring people up in their estimation and valuation and bring themselves down. Another way of putting it is we soberly evaluate ourselves and others by the standard of God's word and not our own personal opinions, right? When you're left to your own personal opinions, you always put yourself high and you start putting other people down, right? Last Lord's Day, we wrapped up the next virtue, which is a chaste heart. And I do want to kind of review that in a little more detail, a chaste heart. Again, what is a chaste heart? That is that habitual and firm disposition to stay sexually pure before marriage and during marriage for the glory of God, right? So that habitual and firm disposition, that's an attitude, that's that being prepared in advance, this is how I'm going to respond, right? It is a firm disposition to stay sexually pure before marriage and during marriage for the glory of God. In other words, you are preparing in advance on how you're going to respond internally to external sexual temptation, right? You're determining in advance how you're going to respond internally to external sexual provocation or temptations, right? So remember, here are some of these internal preparations, these preparing in advance. Job says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why should I think upon a maid? So his plan in advance is, I won't allow myself to look upon that which provokes this sexual desire. I won't allow myself to do it. I've determined in advance to look away. And I will control my imagination. Why should I think upon a woman? I'll control my imagination and do like Paul says. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, think on these things, right? Not that the things that stir up that sexual temptation, that desire. Those are things you don't think on. Planning in advance and then training yourself to this is what you're doing. And you are quite literally fighting a very basic passion you have. Just as the aggression thing is a very basic passion that gentleness of spirit fights against, this chaste heart fights against a very strong passion. And you're training yourself to control it. Paul says, again, preparation in advance. Concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And again, that doesn't mean casual. That doesn't mean platonic. It means that in a relationship in which you are attracted sexually, don't touch a woman, right? Unless you are what? Unless you're married to the woman, right? In other words, if the touching stirs up these desires, then avoid that touching. That's the plan in advance. If the looking stirs up the desires, plan in advance not to look. If the thinking and the imagining stirs up these desires, plan in advance not to do that. That's the virtue. Let me tell you, this is all these virtues are important, but boy, if you don't get control of this virtue, it is such a destroyer of lives, right here. Not getting control of your sexual hungers. It is such a destroyer of lives. So the unbelieving world has no desire to control this passion. So what has been the consequences of giving themselves over to this passion? 50% divorce rate or higher? How many children are aborted? How many sexually transmitted diseases are out there? Some of them deadly. These are the kind of consequences if you don't learn to bring this passion under control. Right? Is the way Paul puts it. Paul's writing to the Galatians 5:13, "For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty. Only use not your liberty for an occasion to the flesh." You hear that? An occasion to the flesh. Don't give your flesh an opportunity. Don't put yourself in a compromising situation. Follow the Pence rule, right? Don't put yourself in a compromising situation where this temptation can take over you. Again, those that don't have a desire to have a chaste heart, then all of this means nothing. Those that have a desire to have a chaste heart, these are critical to a chaste heart. And then finally, Paul says it's better to marry than to burn, right? There's also that part of it as well. Marry, to deal with this. All right, we now come to the next virtue. And this virtue is a modest heart. A modest heart. So let's kind of work out a definition of what modest means. And it comes from a Latin word. And the Latin word means, listen to this, keeping within measure. Keeping within measure. Keeping within bound. Keeping within limit. That's what a modest person does. They keep within bound. And we're going to talk what that bound is and what that measure is. But the idea of modest is they don't go to the extremes. They don't go to the outward edges. They keep within a bound. And a modest heart feels uncomfortable going outside of that bound, that place of modest bound, modest measure. As always, I love to go to Webster's 1828 dictionary. There is great wisdom here because it is so Christian-based in its definitions. Modesty, according to old Webster. Listen, because there's two parts to this thing called modesty, and it fascinates me. Because remember I told you how all these virtues work together, and that in the end, we're going to conclude this, all of these virtues are pulled together into one big virtue, all right? But they all pyramid, they all tee into each other, they all draw from each other, and eventually up to one top virtue. And we'll get that at the end. Don't look. So we're going to find how this virtue of modesty draws on two other virtues we've already learned, right? It draws on them. It's not precisely the same as them, but draws from them, all right? So here we go. The lowly temper, listen to that, a lowly temper, which accompanies a moderate estimation of one's own worth and importance. What does that sound like? Thinking lowly of yourself or soberly of you. What virtue is that? That's the virtue of a humble-mindedness. So modesty springs no less from the principle than from feeling. In other words, it's made up of principles, but it's also made of an internal sense or feeling that you have. And this is a lot of this is you're controlling your internal feelings on these things. And is manifest by retiring unobtrusive manners, assuming less to itself than others, conceding to others all due honor and respect, and even more than they expect or require. Again, thinking higher of others, showing respect to others and honor to others, and not expecting it in return for yourself, thinking lower of yourself. That's modesty, at least part of it. Number two, modesty as an act or series of acts consists in humble, unobtrusive deportment, that's manner, as opposed to extreme boldness, forwardness, arrogance, presumption, audacity, imprudence. Remember the within measure? Not extreme, but within measure. Number three, it means moderation. In fact, decency. And we're going to talk about decency later on because we're going to talk about bounds. The bounds of decency, right? And number four of Webster's dictionary, in females, modesty has the like character as in males. So I'm going to show that later on, that when it comes to this modesty and chaste heart, and that it's for both men and women. Though Paul addresses the women in a verse that we're going to look at, but it's for both. Men are to be modest and women are to be modest in the heart. But the word is used also as synonymous with chastity or purity of manners. In this sense, modesty results from purity of mind in the sexual realm, right? And from the fear of disgrace or ignominy fortified, right? When somebody's outside of that, right? Unaffected modesty is the sweetest charm of female's excellency, the richest gem in the diadem of their honor. Modest woman. This is who can find a virtuous woman thing. That this is one of those qualities that makes a woman truly beautiful. Truly beautiful. Modest. See the two parts? Modesty draws from humbleness of mind. Modesty draws from a chaste heart. So the modest person is both humble and chaste. You follow that? A modest person is both humble and chaste. Again, that is that internal predisposition to respond in humbleness and chastity. This is what modest person is. All right, let's take a look at the verse from which we're drawing this now. And we'll let Paul do some teaching for us. So this is from 1 Timothy 2:9. And remember, he's writing to Timothy to tell him how to set up churches and put them in proper order. So 1 Timothy 2:9, in like manner also, he had just gave instruction to men to stop being wrathful in their prayers. Now he's turning to the ladies. And he says, in like manner also that women adore themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety. So we're going to learn what shamefacedness and sobriety is. We'll even learn what modest apparel means. Not with the broidering of the hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array, but becometh, and we're going to learn what becometh is, women professing godliness with good works. Right? So let me give you the occasion of this exhortation from Paul. So, much of the church that Paul is writing to are Gentiles. So they weren't raised in the nation of Israel with the standards of dress that the nation of Israel had. So these were converted from Greek and Roman societies into the church, and they brought with them the fashion sense of the Greek and the Romans into the church. And so they're sitting in worship with the most modern hairstyle of that time, which apparently, and you actually have pictures and carvings and statues of this hairstyle. If you ever want to see it, it's really impressive. So they had a tendency of lifting up the hair, right? They braid it and then stack it up high, and then they would decorate it. Again, the description here is broided hair, gold, pearls, right? Very elaborate display. And then, of course, their most wealthiest outfits with their jewelry on display. And church. Humbling themselves before God. Again, Paul the Apostle says, ladies, just cover your normal hair. Please, veil in worship, right? Just be modest in that. We have just the opposite here, right? Of modest adornments, we have just the opposite when it comes to these young Christians coming into the faith. So Paul's giving them instructions. I mean, he's not being mean about this. He's just saying, let me tell you about some new standards, all right? Let me teach you about modesty and what that is. And Peter does the same, right? Peter writes the same thing. So this is a uniform teaching among the apostles. Peter says, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of the plaiting of the hair, and the wearing of gold, and the putting on of apparel, meaning rich apparel. Right? This manner of adornment, and the reason I use the word adornment is because it covers not just your clothes. It covers makeup, it covers hairstyle, it covers jewelry, right? Adornment, when you adorn your body. So this manner of adornment was lavish, extravagant, ostentatious, showy, and attention-grabbing. And is it hard? I mean, do I even have to tell you that that's not modest, right? That's not modest. And please notice that here the modesty is not to do with the chaste heart part. This modesty has to do with the humbleness part, right? So this modesty is they were being proud in how they were adorning themselves. They were expressing their pride in their adornment. And Paul says, no, you can't do that as a Christian. He's going to also address the other part, is you can't be sexually provocative in your adornments either, right? And have a modest heart. You can't do either. Right now, all he's focusing on is what the ladies were doing in corporate worship and how they were adorning themselves. This is, you had to. And of course, this also applies to the guys, but they weren't doing that. In fact, it was important for them to actually dress in a manner that's proper to anybody who professes faith. That's that becoming, what becometh a woman. So I also want you to notice that Paul the Apostle here gives examples of what it is to go outside that measure. Remember, modesty has a measure, a bound. He gave examples of the extremes, the outside of it, the boarding of the hair, the extravagance, right? The luxuriousness, the display. What he doesn't do is then give you detailed rules to tell you this is what modesty is. That's what's fascinating here. He really avoids what I call the legalistic pharisaical tendency to start writing a whole bunch of rules. Now, I'm not saying there's not a place for some rules and guidelines, but it's real careful that those rules and guidelines don't go beyond what you're allowed to do. What Paul the Apostle is doing here is, let me teach you an attitude of the heart. Let me teach you the virtue. And once you have the virtue, that's going to guide you in all these other decisions you make when it comes to the adornments, and when it comes to your speech, and when it comes to your conduct. So here's what he says. Listen to how he puts this. He says, in like manner also the women should adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety. The shamefacedness and sobriety, that's the thing in your heart. The modest apparel is descriptive of your adornments outside. The important part here is the shamefacedness and sobriety, which will produce modest apparel outside. And we're going to take a bit of a study and figure out what Paul means by these words. What's shamefacedness? What's sobriety? What does he mean by modest? And what in the world is it mean when he says, it becometh a godly woman? So let's start with modest apparel. So he says, he wants the Christian women to adorn themselves with modest apparel. The word modest is a Greek word that means literally well arranged. Remember, within measure, well arranged, seemly, and then modest. So this idea of well arranged is the idea of nothing clashes, nothing out of order, disheveled, excessive, unpleasant, gaudy, showy, tasteless. That should be tasteful, tasteless, right? It should have a tasteful sense of color, shapes, patterns, cuts that fit, seemly, right? Fits together, proper. That's the idea here. Neat, clean, orderly, humble, moderate. You know, so the word seemly means good taste. Is it decorous? You know what that means? To be decorous. Is it decorous or decorous? Anybody know? I actually looked that up and had the computer tell me this is how you pronounce this word, and it just went out of my head. So it's decor. I think it's decorous. It's from decorate. Do you know your clothes are to adorn you? That means they are not to make you look ugly. They're not to make you look unclean and nasty. They're to adorn you. They're to be decorous, to decorate, decorous. You're not to mar yourself, you're to adorn yourself. And please, in all of this, and I keep emphasizing it over and over, God, Paul's not telling you to dress ugly or dowdy or nasty. He is actually telling you to do just the opposite, but just do it in a modest way. You adorn yourself with modest apparel. You hear that? The word adorn means make you look good. but with modest apparel. So again, listen, you want to look good as a Christian. The world wants to look good as godless. So they adorn themselves in a way that makes them look like what they are. And you as Christians are to adorn yourself to make you look like what you are. To adorn yourself as a Christian is to manifest you who you are inside. That is a modest person. So you're making your clothes conform, or your adornments conform, your manners conform, your words conform to who you are inside. That's modest. Or humble-mindedness, humble-minded and chaste inside. All right, so shamefacedness and sobriety, we'll take those together. Shamefacedness, this comes with the idea of downcast eyes. It comes with the idea of shame. So, and shame is guilt. And shame is also embarrassments. Those kind of go together, right? Downcast eyes. That's the general underlying meaning of the word, but it's more expansive than that. So it's a sense of shame or honor, modesty, bashfulness, reverence, regard for others, respect. Whoa! So you go from a sense of shame to honor, modesty, bashfulness, reverence, regard of others, respect, with this one word, shamefacedness. Again, it's a proper sense of embarrassment, a proper sense of shame, a sense of what is proper and improper when it comes to adornments, what is proper and improper when it comes to your speech, what's proper and improper when it comes to your conduct. It's, in other words, if you say something disrespectful, shame comes upon you as a Christian. When an unbeliever says something disrespectful, pride comes upon them. Shamefacedness is, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. That was just disrespectful. I apologize. That's shamefacedness. When you go shopping and you buy it, you get the latest fashion, let's go see if I can wear this, right? I don't want to stand out like a sore thumb, right? Be different from everybody else around me. So I go into the dressing room and I get that brand new, beautiful little, and you put it on, you go, can't wear that. A sense of shame. I can't wear that, right? Sense of shame. Shamefacedness. What's the opposite of that? Shamelessness. Arrogant. Proudful heart. I do what I want. I don't care. Right? It's a sense of how to act proper and then feeling ashamed when you don't. That's what shamefacedness is. Feeling shame when you're unseemly, unchaste, immodest, rude, offensive, gaudy, showy, excessive, immoderate, you feel shame. And what Paul is saying, you've come out of a culture in which that's not only not shameful, it's promoted, it's encouraged. And Paul says you've got to put on modesty and start seeing this as shameful. Sensing it as shameful, feeling it as shameful. And nobody will be imposing this on you. You will be imposing it on you, right? Nobody outwardly imposes it on you. You are now imposing it inwardly from yourself, on yourself. You are becoming self-governing before God. Let's go with this. So that's that. Shamefacedness, the sobriety. So sobriety in broad general has the idea of not being drunk. But that's not how it's being used here. The use of the word sobriety is soundness of mind. Self-controlled, sound mind. Remember, I keep telling you, created in the image of God, reason and conscience, and that that thing has to rule in you. You have to think clearly, and you have to hear your conscience. That soundness of mind, you can't be stupid, you can't be controlled by your passions, you can't be impulsive, you can't be these things. You can't be silly, you can't be dumb. You've got to think and learn and control. You're an image of God. That's what you're created to do. That's what you're created to be. That's what you've been redeemed to be. So this is no impulse buying, no impulse speaking, no impulse acting, right? This is soundness of mind and self-control. And by the way, take these together. This is that internal sense of a humble mind, right? This is that modest mind. This is that mind that's controlled by this internal sense of propriety and is regulated by clear thinking. Clear thinking. By the way, what's the difference between a child and an adult? Clear thinking. That's the difference. Adults always have the responsibility to make sound judgments about what they can and can't do. Their body, the little two-year-old body they have, their body that's a fully adult but has all the passions and drives of a two-year-old, are going to demand, and you, with that shamefaced, sober mind, must say, no. That's not good for you. No. Yeah, but I want another piece. No, that's not good for you. Yeah, but I want a dress. No, that's not good for you. You are telling you no. Right? Paul would put it this way, the old man and the new man, right? The new man brought alive in Christ, filled with his spirit, looks to the old man with all his passions and foolish thinking and foolish attitudes. The new man says to the old man, no, get down. No. Oh, by the way, finally, the word unbecoming. So the idea of Paul says, in like manner that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but becometh women professing godliness. And that's simply what is appropriate for. Remember back to that measure, right? What is appropriate? What fits the measure? Again, so tell me what's appropriate for a godly person. Tell me what's appropriate for a godless person. That's the point. So are you a godly person? Then what's appropriate for you? What fits you? What's becoming for a person who claims godliness? Over here, you're a person of the world. What fits? What's appropriate for a person of the world? That's what he's saying. There's a verse, and I have it later on. I do have it later on, but we're going to talk about, so what's the appropriate dress for a prostitute? Okay, you get the idea? What's the appropriate dress for a prostitute? Who do you claim to be? Who do you profess to be? Who do you want to be? Now we know what those of the world want to be. We know that. Paul is asking the Christian to start again using that sober mind to say, I want to be Christian. And this is what's appropriate to a Christian. Finally, this does apply to men. That same letter, Paul, in third chapter of 1 Timothy, says this. A bishop must be blameless, a husband of one wife. Listen, sober and of good behavior. That good behavior is the exact same word that says well-arranged, seemly. So this, Paul's addressing the ladies because that's an issue that arose in the church. But Paul also turns around and says that the men have to also have this sober-mindedness and adorn themselves in a proper, well-arranged manner within boundaries of modesty, is what he's saying. In other words, the man is to have a modest heart, a shamefaced heart, a sober heart. All right, quickly, let's summarize, and then let's go. I want to give you a couple of quickie guidelines. The Bible doesn't give you detailed rules on how to adorn yourself, but there are a couple, and so I'll give you some quickies, and then we will try to wrap this up. Okay, so here we go. Here's the summary of what we've learned so far. Number one, modesty is a firm disposition of the heart to be humble and chaste in manner and conduct, right? So modesty in the heart is a firm disposition of heart to be humble and chaste in manner and conduct. Number two, it is an internal sense of what humble and chaste adornment, speech, and actions are. It's an internal sensibility you have that you're putting on. It is a feeling, number three, of shame when you act outside of what is proper to humility and chastity, right? It's a shame. It's a feeling of shame. And number four, letting sound thought and pure conscience guide your manner and conduct, right? So here are a couple of biblical guidelines when it comes to the issue of adornments. And this will also help us kind of distinguish between what is decent and indecent when it comes to adornments as well, just a little bit. So just to remind you, God is the creator of clothes. And what is the purpose of clothes? One purpose of clothes is to cover your shame. Right? That's one purpose. Cover your nakedness. So let me read a couple of verses to kind of get this in your mind. Here it is. So this is Genesis 2:25. So God creates man and woman, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. So this is in the garden. This is before the fall. And they're both married. So there's no effect of sin, and they're within the bonds of marriage, and there's no shame at their nakedness. None. After the fall, after sin enters, Genesis 3:7, and the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. So now, in the fallen state, they know they're naked, and they try to cover that nakedness. Genesis 3:10, and God says, Adam says, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. Then Genesis 3:21, unto Adam also and to his wife did the Lord God make coats of skins and clothed them, covered their nakedness. So one of the functions, one of the purposes of clothes is to cover your nakedness. That's its purpose. So what's another purpose of clothes? To protect you from the weather. What's another purpose of clothes? To identify your calling, right? Another purpose of clothes is to identify a calling. So if you're a police officer, if you're a doctor, right? So three basic functions. Cover your nakedness, protect you from the elements, and identify your calling. And may I add one more? To reveal what's in your heart, right? To reveal what's in your heart. Who you are inside. So notice it says he made a coat of skins. The Hebrew word is a long shirt-like garment, usually of linen. You've heard of a tunic. Well, it's a tunic made of animal skin. Tunic that covers, that you put over like a big shirt and down. That's a tunic covering your nakedness. Now the question is, how far down? How far down did the tunic go? Now there's a grand debate within the church. Among Christians, who care? So is the tunic down to just above the knees, to the knees, to below the knees, to the ankles, to the ground? I'll answer that question by you telling me what is long hair. Because Paul doesn't tell us that. He just wants to maintain distinctions between your adornments, right? So let me give you what Scripture says and no more. All right? Here it is. So under the Old Testament, they had a priesthood and they had an altar. And the priest had to often walk up the altar to offer what he had to offer. So God adorned them with their outfits, but he said to the priest that was offering these sacrifices, you need to wear some breeches. That is some undergarment that's like a pair of shorts to cover your nakedness. Listen to the description here. This is Exodus 28:4. And thou shalt make them linen breeches or breeches to cover their nakedness. From the loins. And everybody knows where this goes. Even to the thighs. Right? Anybody argue that when it comes to sexual attraction, this is the areas, right? Right? Come on. It's the loins and the thighs and the chest, right? That's it. So this tunic went from the shoulders down to cover the thighs. That's it. Now, does that mean to the knees? To above the knees? To below the knees? I don't know. I have no idea. And if you have a chaste heart, that's a non-issue. Let your own internal sensibilities, as you develop this internal sense, let it guide you on these things. I know it doesn't mean short shorts. I can 100% say that God wasn't saying to the priest, be sure to wear some short shorts under those garments. I'm pretty sure. Here's another rule. So, cover your nakedness. Right? And we have a kind of a broad, general area that almost every human being understands is that which is sexually provocative, enticing to other people. Right? That's what you work on covering. Okay? Here's another one. Maintain gender distinctions. Rule number 2. That's what a modest person does. A woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on that garment, a woman's garment. For all that do so are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. That kind of tells you how far down we've fallen as a country. Now, am I giving you any details here? Nope. This stuff varies from culture to culture, people to people. All that it means is wherever you are, figure out what the distinctions are and maintain them. Okay? That's it. I ain't going any further than that. I don't want to become a Pharisee here. That's not my job. Just to give you the general broad principle, what a modest heart does is when it comes to the hair, remember Paul says maintain the distinctions, right? When it comes to the jewelry, maintain the distinction. When it comes to the clothing, just maintain the distinction. That's it. It's funny. So what happens in a society where we no longer maintain the distinctions? You have to identify your pronouns. Oh, I'm a male. Oh, I'm a female. Or I'm a... If you don't maintain the distinctions, if everybody is not identifiable by their outward physicality and their outward adornments, if you can't tell, then, so what are you? What are you? So the woke left, they introduce themselves with their pronouns. Rather than simply letting how they were designed and then adorning how they were designed to let everybody know I'm a male and you're a female. And that distinction, by the way, cut how the cloth is cut, the colors we use, the textures we use, the patterns we use, right? The functions, right? The functions. Man has particular needs, clothes according to function. Women have particular needs according to functions. These are all the ways that we identify that what is here is male and what is there is female. Another rule is moderation. Philippians 4:5, let your moderation be known unto all men. This is really good general rule for almost everything as a Christian. Just be moderate in things. Right? Don't go to the extremes. Don't go to the extravagant, the exaggerated. Just maintain the moderate. In fact, modest and moderate are almost, you can just almost, moderate, modest, interchangeable with it. And of course, dress appropriate to your calling. And here is, again, Proverbs 7:11. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot. So she was dressed appropriate for her calling, right? Did you know your calling is a Christian? Did you know that? It's a calling. So dress appropriate for your calling as a Christian. And finally, respectable, and this one, so the woke left is desperate for women to be shown respectfulness and not to be made into objects of man's desire, and they always worry about that. Don't objectify me. And then my response is, well, then stop dressing like an object. Stop objectifying yourself, and men will stop objectifying you. And so you'd address respectfully, or respectably, I'm sorry. It's also respectfully as other people, but what is to be respectable? In other words, you act and adorn yourself in a manner that promotes respect of you in others. Or you can dress in a manner that people go, phew. Not only does it not stir up respect in me, it stirs up in contempt, dislike. Dress in a manner, again, dress to succeed. Of course, that requires you to be able to kind of put yourself into other people's position and look back at you. So how am I presenting myself to people? How are they seeing me? Am I speaking? Am I acting? Am I dressing in a manner that promotes and encourages respect or disrespect?